Back on Downtown, our next guest on the show is a journalist and author of a number of books, including Paul McCartney, A Life, Bruce, and Homeward Bound, The Life of Paul Simon. His brand new book is entitled Sonic Boom, The Impossible Rise of Warner Brothers Records, From Hendrix to Fleetwood Mac to Madonna to Prince. And we are pleased to welcome back to the program Peter Ames Carlin. Peter, thanks for being with us again.
Well, thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
Man, I love this book so, so much. And you had me right from the get-go as the book opens with a story of Van Dyke Park's friend of our show has been on a number of times, but he's such a great example of what Warner Brothers was really all about.
Yeah. You know, I mean, Van Dyke was this sort of avant-garde composer, arranger, sort of artist in the mid-60s in L.A., and he'd worked with Brian Wilson on that, his notoriously unreleased masterpiece, Smile, that he made for the Beach Boys in 1966, which eventually came out in a slightly different form, you know, when they finally finished it about 40 years later. So Van Dyke was this kind of underground celebrity hero, but, you know, he didn't really have any kind of mainstream elements to him. But when Mo Austin, you know, heard about him and met him, he was just so taken with the guy's brilliance that he signed him to a contract and you know, to be both a house arranger and producer and an artist. And Van Dyke made this incredibly avant-garde record called Song Cycle, which they released in late 1967 that got incredibly great reviews but sold nearly no copies. But Mo still loved it and loved Van Dyke and kept him on the label for 30 years after that, just because he liked to hear Van Dyke's records, and he thought Van Dyke was so brilliant, he deserved to be making records for a mainstream record company.
Now, you got yourself in a proper frame of mind to re-listen to Song Cycle. Do you understand it yet?
Do I understand it? Yeah, you know, I mean, I think that just having the ability to, you know, I think really in my slightly psychedelic experience of that record from a couple years ago that you're describing, I think just being able to sit down and really focus on it and really sort of blot everything else out of my mind was kind of important. It's such a deep record. There's so much going on in it. You know, you really, really need to, as they say, turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. So, and from that point forward, you know, I've enjoyed listening to it sober as a judge.
Well, let's go back to the beginning and the genesis of Warner Brothers Records. And it was as simple, I guess, as Jack Warner not wanting to see others benefit from the soundtracks of Warner Brothers musicals.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that really set him off was the fact that Tab Hunter, who was a Warner Brothers actor, had a number one single for Dot Records. Even though, you know, I mean, it was one of these things where Tab was clearly not a singer, even by his own estimation, but they made a pop record, and he was such a popular, you know, movie star at the time that it just exploded. And when Jack Warner noticed how much money Dot Records was making off of his artist, he was just like, you know, enough of this. And, you know, between that and the soundtracks to the musicals that they were producing, you know, in film, he had them found this record company in 1958, you know, to go along with Warner Brothers Pictures. It was obviously Warner Brothers Records, and gave them just like $2 million in seed money, which wasn't really that much even then, and told them to start a world-class record company. But of course, they didn't have quite enough money to sign artists, at least not like big-time artists. So, you know, they brought in a bunch of different actors and people they already had under contract. You know, Tab Hunter made a spectacularly unsuccessful single or two after his first hit. And then even Jack Webb was, you know, from Dragnet, was reciting love songs, you know, to the delight of nobody. And they had a bunch of artists who, the first president of the label came from a musical family, and you know, his in-laws and friends were all musicians. And so even though most of them were already signed to other record companies, he did deals with them to work for him under the table, recording under pseudonyms. And then the company's first series of releases, you know, many of them were by artists pretending to be other artists, and they collected these and put them out under the most bizarre titles. My favorite in their first release was one they credited to a guitar player named Ira Ironstrings, who of course didn't exist, but they decided to name Music for People with $3.98 plus tax, if any. So that was kind of sort of what they were forced to do for the first couple years of the company's existence.
And eventually they reached the point where they were struggling and given an ultimatum that they had about 6 months to either make it or break it, and they struck gold with the Everly Brothers, whose very first song for the label, Kathy's Clown, went all the way to number one.
Yeah, you know, actually the first thing that kept them in business was the sort of freak hit they had with the soundtrack to 77 Sunset Strip, which was a Warner
right.
Brothers TV show. You know, and that just broke through, and there was some cool music associated with that. And then they had one of the actor who played the character, Ed Kooky Burns, or excuse me, Kooky. the actor was named Ed Burns. He put out a single called Kooky, Lend Me Your Comb, with Connie Francis singing on it too. And that somehow broke through with the soundtrack and sold enough copies to kind of keep the lights on for a few months, at which point that's when they signed the Everly Brothers, and, you know, and they immediately had a number one million selling single with Kathy's Clown. But the real important breakthroughs in 60-61 were when Bob Newhart, the comedian, put
right.
out his first record. That was somebody they just discovered thanks to a friend of a friend who worked at the, you know, at the Warner Brothers warehouse in Chicago, who knew this guy. And his first record, The Button-Down Mind of Bob Newhart, sold multiple millions. And another comedian who did parody songs named Alan Sherman, who we all remember from Hello Mudda, Hello Bada, he came out of nowhere and sold millions of copies of his records out of the box. And that kept them going even in these early days when Jack Warner kept them from recording rock and roll artists.
We're talking with Peter Ames Carlin here on Downtown. His new book is called Sonic Boom. In the early 60s, the company would merge with Frank Sinatra's record label Reprise. And as you point out, that the name of that record company had multiple meanings.
Yeah. Well, I think generally most people pronounced it reprise, like a reprise in, you know, in music when you play something over again. But Frank started the label because he was so aggravated with his own record company. He was recording for Capitol at the time, but for some reason there was some clause in his contract that said he could also release records for another label. So he founded his own boutique label, which most people pronounced Reprise, but he called Reprise. He saw it as a reprisal to these guys at Capitol Records he was so angry at. And then he hired this guy, Mo Austin, to be the sort of be the leader of the company, to sort of be the day-to-day chief executive. And Mo had come up through Verve Records, which was a jazz label, a very sort of artist-friendly jazz label. And so he, you know, and Frank really liked this idea. The idea was just that they were going to record the best artists, you know, that Frank approved of, which were jazz artists and pop artists of his generation. Though Frank, like Jack Warner, was a serious rock and roll hater, and so he forbade them from releasing any rock and roll records, much to his financial chagrin as the years went by. And finally, the labels merged in 1963 when Frank was losing so much money with Reprise, but Jack Warner was so desperate to get him to make movies for Warner Brothers that he agreed to, you know, that if Frank signed this movie deal, that he was going to buy Reprise and merge it with his own record company, you know, and take all that debt off of his shoulders.
And it was, I believe, a young Mo Austin who had to go to Sinatra's house and essentially tell him that, hey, I know they're your friends, but some of these guys aren't selling records and we need to move in a different direction.
Yeah, and Frank was businessman enough where he just sort of like rattled the ice in his Jack Daniels or whatever and just sort of said, okay, do it. And so Mo and managed to cut a bunch of you know, and his A&R guys managed to cut a bunch of these sort of deadwood artists and bring in some newer, more vital ones. But they still had to do this little dance sort of around rock and roll. But the one thing that that allowed them to make a breakthrough was in 1964, they had made a distribution deal with a British company, record company called Pi.
Mm.
And the deal was that Pi could distribute, you know, the Reprise records in England and Europe, and Reprise could distribute the Pi records in the U.S. And one of the acts that Pi had on their roster was the Kinks, and you know, and a few other rock and roll bands. They didn't, you know, they were just happy, you know, perfectly happy releasing rock records. And so, in the early summer of 1964, Mo Austin noticed that, you know, this band, the Kinks, was jumping up the bottom parts of the record charts in England. And so he arranged to release that single of "You Really Got Me" in the U.S. And it wasn't, you know, he didn't have to clear signing them, because they sort of came in through the back door, through this deal with Pi. And lo and behold, "You Really Got Me" was as big a hit in America as it was in the UK, rising into the top 10, I think maybe even into the top 5. And, you know, the flood of cash that came through that kind of softened a lot of those sort of upper corporate executives' concerns about rock and roll.
What I love, one of the many things I love about this book, is that the heroes in this rock and roll story are not the performers as much as the people behind it, the Mo Austins, the Joe Smiths of the world, the Lenny Waronkers, and the unique approach that they had. And how unique was it to say to your A&R people, stop chasing hit singles, just find quality music?
Yeah, that was a big turning point that they made in 1967. You know, even by mid-1966 or so, they were getting a lot more daring. You know, Mo, the two labels at that point were sort of known collectively as Warner Reprise. You know, Mo was kind of essentially the chief executive of the Reprise side, and his compatriot over on the Warner Brothers side was this fellow named Joe Smith, who had started out as a disc jockey, actually, then went into promotions and proved to be so great at hearing, you know, potential hit singles and stuff that they, you know, moved him over into the main executive line, and he became the sort of day-to-day president of Warner Brothers. And by the late summer of 66, he was, you know, he had signed the Grateful Dead, who were then just like a pretty hot, you know, ballroom dance band in San Francisco on the new psychedelic scene. And exactly the same time he was doing that, Mo Austin was getting hip to Jimi Hendrix, who was, you know, beginning to make a big splash in England, over in London. And so by the start of 67, they had, you know, these two very prominent, you know, sort of psychedelic acts, you know, the Dead and Hendrix. And when the Monterey Pop Festival took place in June of 67, and both Hendrix and the Dead played there, and Hendrix was like the huge discovery. And right after that, they released his first album in the U.S., Are You Experienced, which sold like 3 million copies out of the box. And, you know, and right around then, you know, Mo and Joe got complete authority over who they were going to sign. And they both agreed that the thing they needed to do right then was to pivot toward, you know, more sophisticated rock and roll music. You know, this idea that people have had earlier that the teeny boppers, you know, the sort of the young baby boomers who loved the Beatles and screamed over them and Herman's Hermits and all these others in the early 60s, they were growing up and becoming more mature. And, you know, a lot of the older execs were pretty sure that when they became more sophisticated, they were just going to give up the rock and roll and go back and listen to Sinatra and, you know, and the jazz people. But what Mo and Joe understood was that that wasn't going to happen. They were just going to want to listen to more sophisticated rock and roll music, you know. And that was the point at which Mo sort of gathered the A&R people in, you know, the late summer of 67 and said, look, we need to stop trying to make hit records. Let's just make good records and turn those into hits. And part of that philosophy was a new emphasis on recording albums as opposed to, you know, 45 RPM singles, which had dominated the industry to that point. And doing that, suddenly, you know, you had like Hendrix selling multiple millions of his album, and, you know, and then they began to sign other artists that were like that, like Joni Mitchell and Neil Young and Captain Beefheart and Randy Newman and Van Dyke Parks, who we discussed earlier, and a whole variety of other very kind of avant-garde-ish, very sort of left-of-center types of hippie artists. And it would have seemed like commercial suicide to say, let's not try to have hit singles. But they, you know, were so prescient in reading what was going to happen with, you know, the rock and roll culture, and this, you know, culture of young, you know, but rapidly growing baby boomers, was that, you know, 3 years later, they were the top selling label in the United States.
One of the other great characters in the book is Stan Kornan, who came up with such interesting and unique advertising campaigns. But as you point out, not all the artists loved what Stan was doing.
Yeah, you know, Stan had been a liner note writer and did other sort of editorial stuff, you know, writing press releases and stuff. But he was clearly a very smart and very creative guy. And he, in 1968, I guess, the person who was the head of advertising decided to go to law school. So they made, they decided to make Stan the new director of advertising. And one of the reasons they thought he was so perfect for the job was because he hated advertising and had never written an ad and had no interest in it. But basically the idea that he had was, you know, there's barely any advertising for rock records as it is. And what there is, you know, what there was at that point was so badly done. So what he realized was that as the company was changing its focus in terms of the music and the, you know, the artists they were signing, the records they were putting out, then they also would want to change their sort of their identity, their kind of personality, because they needed to pivot from being seen as kind of the home of Sinatra and Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. and Peter, Paul, and Mary into being, you know, the home of the Grateful Dead and Jimi Hendrix and all these counterculture bands. So he created this jaw-dropping series of ads, you know, that he would put into Rolling Stone magazine and underground newspapers across the country. And, you know, for instance, the one to promote the Randy Newman record, this is a full-page ad. They were all full-page ads that had big headlines on the top, big attention-grabbing headlines, a photo, and then like a little mini-essay. And for the Randy Newman record, the headline was, once you get used to it, his voice is really something, you know, because Randy Newman had that, you know, he's got that kind of slurry voice, you know, he sounds, somebody described him once as, I think, Ray Charles after a shot of Demerol or something, you know, that sort of New Orleans bluesy burr that he's got going on. You know, Randy wasn't crazy about it, but it drew a lot of attention to the record, you know, even though I don't think that one sold very well. It took a few years for Randy to break through, but it also drew attention to the fact that there was this record company that was completely different from all the other record companies. And the counterculture people, who were their primary target for their audience, really began to pay attention and began to admire them. You know, he did an ad for Van Dyke Parks' record that Van Dyke hated, but also got attention, that was essentially writing, it was an ad basically trying to convince people to buy Song Cycle. And the first one in the series said something like, how we lost, you know, $35,509.20 on the quote, album of the year, close quote. And then open parentheses, damn it, close parentheses. And basically, and this was something he would do repeatedly, it's like, this is, he would basically implore the readers, the audience, to say, look, you guys aren't buying this record, but we think it's fantastic. You know, we know this is a great record and you're going to love it. Just, you know, just give it a chance, you know. And the ads were so funny and so offbeat. And so, you know, I mean, the second ad for the Randy Newman thing, which, you know, after the first ad didn't sell any more records, then the next ad for the record said, want a free album? okay. And the deal was, if you just send in your name and address, they would send you a copy of Randy Newman's record because they were so sure you were going to love it. And it just, you know, it just created this whole sort of sense of Warner Brothers Records being the, you know, basically the commercial face of the hippie counterculture.
I remember those ads so well from my jaded youth. But also, I thought another brilliant marketing plan, their loss leaders, their samplers, where they would send out compilations with maybe a couple songs from each of their new albums.
Yeah, they would take, they called them loss leaders, these records. And I think the first one was called the Warner Brothers or the Warner Reprise Record Show. And then the next one was, you know, the Warner Brothers Music Show. And they would be double album, you know, double record sets with about, you know, like 20 plus songs on them, you know, usually one or two from a whole variety of artists who had new records out. And they would, you know, they were mail-in deals, and they only cost like $2. You know, and one of my early music memories from, you know, 1969, when I was about 6 years old, was that my dad got one of those records, and we were listening to it, and I was, you know, looking at the cover and all the art and the liner notes and everything, and it was just, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of perspective on the culture in general, but I could tell from the start that this was a very, very different kind of for-profit business.
What did the ownership of Steve Ross mean to Warner Brothers?
Well, Steve Ross eventually bought the company. You know, I mean, Jack Warner had sold originally, when he decided to sell Warner Brothers, to this other company called Seven Arts, and then they held on to it for 2-3 years and then sold it to Steve Ross, who was then just sort of coming into his own, starting, you know, he had started in his father-in-law's business that began with funeral homes and parking lots or something. But Steve began to, you know, was really interested in getting into show business. And so he bought Warner Brothers, you know, knowing that instead of buying, you know, a movie company that was struggling a little bit, that also happened to have record companies, he was buying record companies that just happened to have, you know, happened to be associated with a movie company. And he gave Mo Austin and Joe Smith and the other presidents of the record companies that they had at that point, which included Atlantic Records, he was so in awe of what they could do with music that he just sat back and said, "You guys do what you do, and I'm not going to bother you at all." And he gave them an incredible amount of independence, which was why Mo could, you know, could pursue this policy he had of putting the artists and the music before the profit. You know, that was kind of the, one of the, you know, sort of the central philosophy of the company, was that, you know, they were going to run it sort of like a for-profit music commune, you know, where they would have a certain number of pop acts and people who were popular who were going to make a lot of money, and they were going to use the profits to subsidize artists like the Grateful Dead and Randy Newman and Van Dyke Parks and, you know, and these other sort of freaky artists who might or might not break through. And part of what Mo was banking on was this idea that if you gave an artist time to really sort of discover their voice and connect with an audience, you know, while they were making the music that they wanted to make, they were going to make better records, and this audience was going to, you know, when they found them, were going to be intensely loyal and continue to buy their records over, you know, not just a matter of weeks or months, but years and decades. And that's exactly what's been going on. I mean, they lost money on the first 3 or 4 Grateful Dead records until the Dead broke through in 1970. And even now, you know, almost 60 years later, they're still making money off those early, even the early Grateful Dead records that didn't sell at first. You know, once the audience caught up with them, suddenly there was demand, and they make a ton of money every year still from the catalog sales of the artists that Mo and Joe signed in the late 60s and early 70s.
You point out in the book, Peter, they had a little early 80s slump, but then bounced back in a big way with Prince and Purple Rain, Madonna, on through Paul Simon's Graceland album, and into the 90s with Petty and R.E.M., U2, the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and then things changed. And if there's a villain in your story, would it be Robert Morgado?
Yeah, well, he was an executive that Steve Ross hired out of the political world. I think he was an advisor to then New York Governor Hugh Carey, And he came into Warner's working for Steve Ross, kind of being his hatchet man to some degree, because he was good at firing people and slimming things down, you know, and Steve was kind of the good cop character, the good, you know, dad-like figure. But what happened was when Steve Ross began to get ill in the early 90s, he was suffering from cancer, you know, Morgado got more and more power in the company, and one of the things that he had always wanted to do was to gain control over the record company. And while Steve Ross was alive, he wouldn't allow it because he knew that, you know, Mo and Ahmet Erdogan over at Atlantic and these other record company presidents that they had knew something about their business that he, Steve Ross, and other executives, you know, mainstream corporate executives, didn't know. And so there was no point trying to second guess them or order them around, because God only knew what you were going to miss as a result, you know, because there was a certain X factor with a good sort of music / creative executive, someone who understands artists and knows that art is a very sort of, you know, a quirky thing that's hard to describe in an intellectual way. But then when Steve Ross got sicker and then passed away in late 1992, this fellow, Robert Morgado, got enough power where he did, in fact, take over the record companies and made it very clear to them, to the presidents, that they were not going to be allowed the independence they'd once had. And even though Warner's had made, you know, the Warner Record Company under Mo Austin had made just unfathomable amounts of money over nearly three entire decades, he essentially ran Mo out of the company and replaced him with, you know, another executive, you know, who was going to be more loyal to Morgado. But, you know, the company just lost its rudder at that point, and people, you know, artists began to leave and executives began to leave, and, you know, and then the company really sort of hit a death spiral after that, which they managed to pull out of to a great degree. There was a bit of a reformation, you know, later, you know, within a year or two. But by then Mo was gone, and he took Lenny Warnker, who was his, you know, Mo was the chairman of the company and Lenny was the president, and they worked hand in hand. They were very, very close, and they both shared that artist-friendly philosophy. And they went off and started the record company for Steven Spielberg and David Geffen, mm-hmm. over at DreamWorks, and sort of got going over there. But by then the industry had changed so much with, you know, I mean, Napster began and sales really sort of fell through the floor, and, you know, and then eventually streaming became a thing. So, you know, it's hard to imagine any record company being able to make the hundreds of millions, billions of dollars that Warner Brothers managed to over the years.
Sonic Boom ends with a very poignant conversation that you had with Mo Austin. And man, I would love to have just been a fly on the wall for that. What was that experience like?
You know, it was really cool. It took, you know, one of the things when I first started doing the book, you know, I knew that Mo was very interview shy. He didn't like to talk about himself, and he had just rarely, if ever, you know, barely ever really been interviewed, and certainly not in any kind of real heavily personal way. And so when I started working on the book, you know, I began to get in touch with these executives who had worked for him. You know, they would say, like, oh, well, I'm so glad you're going to do this book, you know, because no one, you know, there hadn't been a really, really big book about the company except for one in-house one they did, which was really nice, had a lot of great photos and great stuff in it that came out for the 50th anniversary. But they said, like, you know, it's going to be really hard for you to do this book without Mo, and unfortunately Mo will never talk to you. But as it turned out, you know, a few of them, I think, began to lean on him a little bit, saying, you know, it's time for us to kind of get our due, you know, to have our story told. And then his son, Michael Austin, who, you know, had been an A&R guy at Warner's and then went with his dad over to DreamWorks and is, you know, quite a, you know, a brilliant executive on his own. I think he finally leaned on his dad enough that Mo agreed to do some interviews with me. And we eventually talked for, you know, we had three real full days of interviews that went to like 20 hours or something like that. And we talked in great depth about a lot of it. And Mo, you know, at the time, it was like 91, 92 years old. This was a couple of years ago. But he, you know, it's amazing how sharp that guy is. I mean, his level of detail that he can summon, just talking about, you know, record contracts that he had signed 60 years ago, you know, he can break it down to individual clauses and also how those clauses evolved in subsequent renegotiations. And I can't even tell you what I had for breakfast today. He's an amazing man, you know, and also, you know, just given the way that he did business, always in a very sort of collegial way, you know, he's just roundly beloved, you know, not just by the artists who recorded for him and the people who worked for him, but also by, you know, industry observers and his competitors. You know, I mean, I talked to Clive Davis, you know, who was obviously at Sony and Columbia and, you know, one of Moe's biggest competitors, and, you know, and David Geffen as well. And they just think the world of Moe, you know, even as hard as they competed against him. There's so much sort of affection and admiration for this man. It's really something else.
The book is called Sonic Boom, The Impossible Rise of Warner Brothers Records, from Hendrix to Fleetwood Mac to Madonna to Prince. And Peter, I always loved your books. This was such a great ride because what it did for me is it reminded me of the joy in experiencing that music when I was younger, and the joy that the leaders of that company had in finding and nurturing these artists. It's a great look back at a wonderful time that we'll probably never see again in the music business.
Yeah, you know, you never really know what's going to happen next. And guys like me and you, you know, these veterans of pop culture, it's like, you know, we're probably not the ones who are going to figure it out first. You know, it's our kids and grandkids who are going to, like, suddenly figure out, you know, the next great stuff and, you know, and all that. But, you know, there was something, what I love the most about the Warner Brothers story and everything is just the idealism that went into it, just the admiration they had for the artists and the art, and the fact that, you know, what they figured out is that if you don't make money your top priority, if you actually prioritize the art, you may well end up making way more money than you thought possible. And that's exactly what they did for, you know, nearly 30 years.
Well, it's a great story and a wonderful ride reading Sonic Boom. Peter Ames, Carlin, great to talk with you again, Peter. Thank you so much for making some time for us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Rich.